discussion because we had mentioned, we were talking yesterday about the fact that Trinavarta represents pride in mundane scholarship, which leads to mental speculation and so on. How Krishna's killing Trinavarta represents the removal of such an anartha of pride in mundane knowledge or mundane scholarship, rather. So I was especially talking about modern material science and how, even though they don't know anything, still they put forward claims to knowledge. I had a discussion with this about Srila Prabhupada when he was in Philadelphia, and we were in the car driving. I didn't think this was taped, there wasn't a tape on. He said to me, he said, I could understand if they just said, we don't know. He said, you're a resident of this city. If somebody stops and asks you for directions to some place, and you say, I don't know, what's the fault? But even though you don't know, you still give him directions. And he said, then that is objectionable. And of course, we know many people who cannot resist the temptation to give directions even though they don't know the way. Because one wants to be known as, oh, I look like an idiot, you know, if I don't know the directions. So that's why people are wandering all over the city looking for places. So anyway, this is the case of modern material science. Although they have only a fragment of information available, they take whatever information they have, some of which, of course, is false to begin with. It's not even that everything they've collected is true. And then they organize it according to certain conceptions of grouping things in certain way, according to certain schemes of categories or abstractions that they fit it into. And those categorical schemes are themselves subject to change. And so you can even have the same information and then reorganize it completely different in the light of further information or disinformation. But anyway, they take whatever they happen to know, and then they tell a story about it as though it's the complete story. This is always happening. Even though, I remember a while ago, you know, some people of the Christian right wing are trying to get certain states to put in what they call scientific creationism in the textbooks. And of course, people are outraged by this, and there's several fights. Anyway, somewhere in the state of California, some of these people managed to get in a position of sufficient power to actually propose a series of changes to the way science is taught in the schools. And somewhere I read an account of what they had proposed, and the person who was giving an account of it said, you know, actually, this is not so bad what they're saying. Because he said all they did was go through, you know, with the presentation of the theory of evolution and just tone down completely wild claims to knowledge. he said, actually, it's nothing bad at all. For when they say we know, instead they say, you know, we think or we guess or we hypothesize, or based on what we know now, we say, you know, things like that. But the point is they don't hesitate to speak as authorities when actually they have no grounds for it. And so they take a little bit of whatever they think they know, and especially, as I said, with the past and history, the data is permanently missing. Even written history, I mean, not about to speak of what they call prehistory when there is no written record, but even written history is based on whatever happens to survive. what didn't get destroyed, what didn't get lost, what didn't get thrown away, and what survives and what doesn't survive is completely accidental. And yet then they try to reconstruct on these little fragmentary things a complete picture. So, and then you get back before prehistory, here's a guy and he's got, you know, three chips of bones, a couple of potsherds, and a hunk of iron, and reconstructs a civilization on the basis of it. And this is it, you know, this is in this valley civilization, or this is that. And then somebody digs up something new, and they don't hesitate to completely change the whole story and say, oh, we're so excited. Without ever saying, you know, actually, we've defrauded and misled and lied to a whole generation of students. And you go look at all the textbooks on the Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, these Indo-European civilizations, you know, what they're pre-Indo-European civilizations, excuse me, that they're supposed to be, that are found in India, Harappa, Mohenjo-Daro, there are these little seals left, and they have a seated figure on the seals. Because of certain features, they decide is proto-Shiva. And they also think they found, along with that, Shivalingams. You know, these little round sort of ovals, kind of long, elongated oval stones. Anyway, this is dogma. You go back and you look, yeah. And so they got a whole thing, you know, that Shiva and these are Dravidian gods, and then Aryans came in with Indra and they amalgamated. I mean, they tell a whole piece of science fiction about this thing. I happened to be at every courses I had in Indian archaeology, you read the book. I took one course in anthropology of India when I discovered, this is before I became a devotee, that nobody knew anything. It was just wild. The actual Aryan invasion on which everything is based on, there's no evidence for it. This one scholar got up and on the basis of other digs everywhere else, she completely demolished this proto-Shiva hypothesis. Completely. And I was amazed, you know, because so much had been made of, and there's all these different reasons, I won't get into the things, but there was a whole analysis of Shiva lingams, and it showed that these round features of these round stones were some kind of architectural stones, had nothing to do with worship. But anyway, one thing after another, after another, after another, after another. And I was amazed because all these scholars were sitting there going, yep, 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 yep. And every one of them for the past, you know, as long as they've been teaching, had been telling their students with great authority just the opposite. And there was not one expression of remorse. Oh, we've misled all these people. You know, don't even say, I'm sorry. They say, oh, this is progress. So, now to illustrate this, this is something I have fun with every week on Tuesday, the science section of the New York Times. And it never fails to have something. So I just happened to pick up this one. Of course, many of the science articles are about man-made disasters using science. There's two of them here. But anyway, the first thing I found out, you're right here, new class of lightning found high above the clouds. It turns out when there's thunderstorms, there's lightning that strikes below. But above the clouds, there are a certain kind of lightning flashes that soar as high as 60 miles above the earth. Much bigger than anything. Now, how long have people been flying above the clouds? You know, since about 1915 or so. People have been looking, you know. This means everything that you've ever heard about lightning is wrong. I mean, as far as giving a complete picture, not everything you've heard, but, you know, the complete picture of what lightning is. Listen to this. Science scientists have been studying lightning ever since Benjamin Franklin demonstrated, so on and so forth, its electrical nature, and have generally felt that its nuances were understood. And so they, though dazzling to the eye, lightning as a scientific topic had become rather passé, because we know all about it, there's nothing new to discover, we understand it completely. You know, the same old boring textbooks year after year describes lightning, go on to the next thing. But it turns out that science has missed the most bizarre and interesting bolts of all, which materialize above thunderheads and shoot upward, not downward, flickering across great distances. Such wonders. Now, here's a lie, because later on, they actually, you find out, they take it back, but they don't acknowledge. Such wonders were hidden from view until recently. But actually, they talk about all the times that they were seen and everybody didn't pay attention. Which is, you know, why didn't they pay attention? Why not? Now, all of a sudden, everybody's seeing them. Before, nobody saw them. Now, everybody's seeing them. Why? We talked yesterday about the phenomena of attention and somebody saying, look for this, look for that. And, oh, yeah, there it is, right? Such wonders were hidden from view until recently, when ground observers, aircrafts, and spacecrafts managed to glimpse their ephemeral dance. But they weren't hidden, actually. Nobody was looking. And when people reported it, they say, no, we already understand lightning. You couldn't have seen it. Hundreds of flashes, some pink, some blood red, others dark blue, have now been photographed above electrical storms, the red one soaring as high as 60 miles above the Earth. Their wispy tendrils playing out along the fringes of outer space, their lower parts turning bluish or purple before disappearing. Remarkably, this intriguing new class of lightning, how long has it been around? And why do they call it new? I mean, now just look at this habit of thought. It's as though they made it. They're passing it off to you, this new class of lightning, you know? That's far out. I mean, how much, doesn't that give away a lot that they have this new class of lightning? See, look, what's being covered up here is abysmal ignorance for years in which hundreds of thousands of people were systematically misled as to the nature of lightning and on certain claims of knowledge. And now, it's as though, really, you know, here it is, the new automobile from General Motors, see? What we've got given you now? They're all like this. Every one of them is just such a cheating. Remarkably, this intriguing new class of lightning is visible to the naked eye if you know where to look. The flashes appear to be prepared to produce strange emanations. Right? Formerly known as metaphysical, anyway. Strange, new age, whatever. Strange emanations that are just starting to be measured and are far from being understood. You can say that again. Orbiting satellites have detected gamma ray bursts of extraordinary intensity coming from thunderheads, and the red flashes have been linked to powerful bursts of radio waves. Scientists are now racing around the globe to study the phenomena and its implications. May affect the ozone layer and so on and so forth. And most important, the flashes promise. This is just beginning. Flashes promise to reveal fundamental truths about the workings of the Earth's global electric current and a region of the high atmosphere once thought of as generally uninteresting. What's neat? Now listen to this nerd. What's neat is that we didn't expect it. It's probably been there since the Earth began. But our eyes have just been opened. This is an astrophysicist who's got a doctor in front of his name. That, see, you can be all this and just say something as stupid as that. National Aeronautic and Space Administration. For now, a NASA jet was going to be loaded with cameras and instruments will fly across the thunderstorm belt, analyzing it, and so on and so forth. Here's another one. They're not hard to see if you know what to look for and where to look. It's like Krishna, actually. It's not hard to see if you know what to look for, where to look, but they won't accept it, you know. So this other guy, he's... the phenomena, he said, is a whole new thing that nobody knew about, and they have lots of implications, adding, that's exciting. Notice how they're into excitement. Another one of them says, it's a new discovery that raises the level of excitement. It's much more frequent than anyone suspected and appears to be distributed around the globe. You see, so like this hidden thing that nobody could see, remember before, first paragraph? What did they say? Not a recent discovery. A new class. Such wonders were hidden from view until recently. Now they're all over the place. They're distributed everywhere. They've been going on since time began. And people have been flying above the clouds, as you know. I can understand if you're rooted on the ground, but airplanes have been flying above the clouds since, you know, the turn of the century, you know. So there's almost 100 years of ability to see them. What to speak of balloons going up above the clouds, right? So they say they've been hidden from view until recently, and now we discover that they're not rare. They're all over the place, and every thunderstorm, they're, you know, distributed around the globe, much more frequent. Okay, all right. Then they talk about all these scientific... Okay. It's one of those cases where you thought you knew everything. Still no apologies, right? Said a program manager for flash studies at NASA. Then something pops up that you never expected. The theoreticians are going wild. See, they're going to do the same thing again. Science learns from its mistakes. It learns how to repeat them exactly with precision. Now listen to this, right? Nobody saw them before, right? What did I say? They had, I can't even remember what it said. Hidden from view until recently, right? It turns out that the mysterious bolts were periodically seen by airline pilots over the decades. Right? Now, there's a whole area of utter imbecility and stupidity that is just completely whitewashed over, you notice? And that is actually being seen by airline pilots over the decades, but never made scientific waves because it was exclusively visual evidence, which is often belittled as fleeting and unreliable. For example, and then they give all these airline pilots who see this stuff and nobody believed them, right? On that occasion, they don't say when this pilot saw this on an American Airlines jet. And he's seen them many, many times. That's so much for fleeting and unreliable. I mean, there's a real double standard of evidence here. He later wrote the magazine Aviation Week in Space Technology, saying it was the most spectacular and unexpected natural event he had ever witnessed. This is an airline pilot, you know, and so on. These aren't, you know, space cadets, usually. But we got the, the first photograph was 1989 by accident. Somebody photographed it, and so on. That talks about the history of photographs. So still, you know, that was, what, 5 years ago. So then there's a history of 60 miles up. To describe the two different kinds of them goes on and so forth. Okay. Now, okay, let's get to the end. As sighting of sprites, jets, some are called sprites and others are called jets because there's two kinds, one lower and one higher. If you want, you can borrow this and find out all you want to know. As the sighting of sprites, jets, and other riddles have multiplied into a torrent. See, all of a sudden, everyone's seeing. Before, nobody saw them. Now everyone's seeing them. Right? Why? And moreover, what are they not seeing now that's literally in front of their faces? What are they not seeing now? Just imagine. But nevertheless, the theoreticians are going wild. Right? Because that means they're going to put together a whole complete explanation now of lighting. Now that we know this, now we understand it. And they're going to put together a whole complete explanation of lightning. And then, you know, still they haven't learned, you know, anything about what they might not know. Physicists have vowed to explain them with new theories being advanced all the time. Right? Mm-hmm. No consensus has emerged. So anyway, they're going to take more measurements. Dr. Howard of NASA headquarters said a scientific assault on the mysteries. There's a certain covert hostility there, huh? Assault on the mysteries was taking shape over the next 2 years. It might include observers, balloons, radar, satellites, planes, and a wide assortment of cameras and instruments. A lot of people are interested in trying to understand these things, he said. Right now, there's a lot we don't know. Famous last words, huh? As though, you know, in a little while we'll understand it all, we'll have it down. No, no, you know, no humility, no apologies, no... They said, oh, this is so exciting, we're going to have to rewrite all the textbooks, you know, because we've lied to you. Okay. Now, here's another one, just to let you know. Another thing. What's new about spider webs? Notice this. New again, right? The scientists have invented spider webs. It takes a computer to know. Now here's your humble arachnid, you know, you're a common spider. One of those little tiny low-level creatures, right? The dynamics of catching a meal are lessons for engineers. Using a computer model to study the behavior of spider webs, researchers say they have discovered the solution to what one of them described as a crucial problem for the spider. Whose solution? The spider's solution, right? They don't give the spider any credit. Somehow or other, they're taking the credit, right? One of them described as a crucial problem for the spider. How to stop a relatively massive insect moving at a fast speed. Now look at these fellows, huh? If the web were too stiff, said Lorraine H. Lynn, a structural engineer and author of a new study on spider web dynamics. If the web were too stiff, the insect would bounce back out like hitting a trampoline, adding, if there was too much give, the threads would break.
As a fast-moving insect hits the web, a fine net stretching over a relatively large area, the impact stretches and deforms its fibers, the researcher said. The drag produced by the movement of the web against the air helps to dissipate the energy of the blow. This aerodynamic resistance improves the chance of the web staying intact by quickly dampening vibrations and increases the likelihood of the insect sticking to the web long enough for the spider to reach the kill. The scientists at Oxford University in England trying to figure out how advanced the spider is, right? You'll see they don't give any credit to the spider. The scientists at Oxford University in England said this property of the circular or orb webs of the common garden spider, Araneus diadematus, also causes the web to billow like a sail in a breeze, a factor that increases its chance of being destroyed in a high wind. Taking this danger into account, they said, some spiders apparently try to control the benefits and risks of the web's air resistance by building it at an angle to the primary direction of the prevailing wind. Pretty good, huh? They take it into account and they figure, just like Oxford dons. So here in the current issue of the journal Nature, several spiderologists from Oxford, together with the structural engineer, Miss Lynn, who's an engineer with Ove Arup and Partners, an international engineering construction concern in London, they joined to examine the orb spider's web. The researchers built a computer model of a web using a customized version of a structural analysis program that is mainly used for automobile crash simulations. They're going to really help the spider out, aren't they, huh? The computer simulations indicate that while the stiff supporting threads of the web dissipated energy from the impact of an insect, this reaction was not enough to account for all the energy absorbed in the web. Only by including the air resistance or drag caused by the rest of the net could the behavior of real webs be reproduced. The researchers said they confirmed their computer findings by firing styrofoam bullets at real webs. Including some with sections of the web net cut away to reduce aerodynamic dampening that disperses energy. Dr. George Utz of the University of Cincinnati, a biologist who specializes in spider behavior, said the new research was significant because, listen to this, they are applying new technology to an ancient biological structure and coming up with interesting, unexpected results. So then it goes on, okay, to discuss the wonders of the web. What an incredible, you know, they're discovering how well it works. So they discussed the wonders of the web for so long. Experts believe that spider silk, thin, water-soluble threads with a breaking strength greater than steel, first evolved 400 million years ago. I mean, they just move right into it. You know, you need computers and styrofoam bullets and Oxford professors and all this other stuff just to understand how it's done. And now, how did it happen, you know? Just
research is increasingly showing that these webs, far from being simple nets that snare passing insects, are dynamic structures that respond to their immediate environment and even embody characteristics to attract prey. Now put this all together and imagine it evolving. It's not just a simple little structure. It's got, you know, all this, and remember, not one part of it's really going to work unless the whole thing works well, you know? And then it talks about the spider creates orb webs by making two types of thread, a framework of dry radial threads that radiate from the center like spokes in a wheel, and overlay where a spiral of flexible, wet, glue-covered strands. While the radial threads are taut and under a slight tension, when the thread is at its resting state, the spiral strands are elastic and expand or contract in their length as the conditions change. The glue on the spirals not only help entangle insects with its stickiness, but also absorb ambient moisture. Listen to this. So there are two functions. See this sticky thing. Absorbs ambient moisture. This water forms droplets along the thread, and the surface tension of the water and the droplets pull the elastic strands into little bundles to keep them from sagging when not under pressure. This droplet mechanism rapidly reels the thread in and out to keep it straight, depending on the load and pull on it. The researchers found that the presence of these glue droplets increased the wind resistance of the web and enhanced aerodynamic dampening by about 35%. The web is a very dynamic structure made up of two types of threads, ones that super elastic and ones that isn't, Miss Lynn said, and together they solve the spider's crucial problem. The spider actually has what Prabhupada calls mystic potency to make that web. Obviously, the spider has a very tiny, it's not a really bright animal, but it is endowed with mystic potency. And what they do is they attribute to evolution mystic potency, what it comes down to. I saw another one. Anyway, that's the payoff, you know, just evolved, you know. The other two ones are all about how Japan is, mistakes. Including one about eyewitnesses. They found out that the conviction when people identify people as eyewitnesses in courts has nothing to do with the accuracy of their memory, which is interesting. If they think other people also identified them, then they're convinced. But scientific data shows many flaws in how people identify eyewitnesses. Anyway, article a while ago on another article in the Science Times on evolution, and it was a discovery that some DNA or some codes for some structures that in one animal forms one function gets used in others. For other same structure gets used in a different way. Everybody was naturally excited and thrilled and awestruck. And a huge chunk of the article, I wish they'd saved it now, was talking about, you know, this is really good because, you know, if you were designing something, you'd be really efficient and, you know, you'd take the same structure, the same thing that's used for one thing and just adapt it for something else. Why start all over again at zero when you can take what you've already got and use it somewhere else, right? And they went on and on about, you know, how, you know, this is just the right rational way to proceed. Well, then, of course, what they're describing is evolution, which is just, you know. And I had heard a similar discussion about the rationality of it from Sariputta, who pointed out that one of the big objections to evolution is the fact that, for example, you know, it's horse's thumbs. You know, basically, if you take an X-ray of a horse's hoof, you found that basically what you've got is an animal that's standing on its forefinger. That hoof is this fingernail. you know, made big. And you can see vestigial bones of the thumb and the other fingers back up there, undeveloped. This is what a horse is. It's standing like this on its fingers. And that this fingernail has become a hoof. Right? So this is one of the arguments against creation, according to them. You know, it has to be evolution that there's this structure and then it gradually changes. Or the fact that, you know, if you look at the flippers of a whale, you see finger bones inside the flipper. Sariputta says, well, wait a minute, you know, if you're God and you're making something, why not take the same basic design and modify it? You know. So these fellows, in talking about this adaptation of structure, you know, all excited about it, somehow or other, and it's so rational, and then right away they just talk about how wonderful it is that evolution works that way. You know. So certain things cannot be questioned. Anyway, I thought you should understand what every time that, you know, as they find more and more out about spider webs, they discover just how cunning and clever and adroit and a spider is. They didn't know all this thing. They thought it was just a simple web that hung there, and now they find out it's, you know, you need computer models to understand how it works, and somehow or other it just popped into being without any instructions or blueprints. And although the Oxford scholars get all kinds of credit for understanding it, the spider seems to be singularly free of any awards or Nobel Prizes or anything like that. It's incredible. If anybody made a little piece of thread that had, you know, 100 times the tensile strength of steel, you know, people would be pretty amazed. Anyway, here this is just brainless process. And here's another typical thing about how, you know, lightning, the well-understood phenomena, turns out to be not well-understood. But it will be very well understood in just a short time, have faith. You know. So these are the things that are going on all the time. And you notice this whole area of ignorance, and you notice just like the total lack of humility that's here. No one confesses we didn't know anything. No one confesses our textbooks are lies, what we told you. And that therefore whatever we're doing now is likely to be just as wrong. It's just likely to be just as wrong. If they just gave us collections of data, this is what we know so far about lightning, and we have already had the experience of discovering many things, something we well don't understand, so you might as well take it for granted that there's probably a whole lot more we don't know. You know, they don't say like that. They don't say like that. Why not? So, anyway, this is speculation. You don't know, but you have to say, oh yeah, turn left here, turn right here, you'll get there. And then the whole world is misled. Any questions, comments? Yeah. Yeah, right. Plenty of eyewitness reports, very reliable people, many more than for this lightning stuff and stuff like that. And yet because, you know, people will have to rearrange their mental furniture too much to accommodate it, they just ignore it. You know. Sure. Yeah. You're going to say if you accept one thing on the basis of these things, and by the way, they accept many, many things on just one little object, you know, just like, oh, somebody sees a flash of something. If somebody sees a little flash of something and it fits in a theory and confirms everything, everybody jumps on the bandwagon like crazy. Come on, they don't doubt it at all. As you see what happened, like how this Java man got accepted, you know, there's really a double standard for evidence that's being put forward to people. Nobody, the real fact is that what people have to say, if they just want to tell the truth, is here we are, this is material nature, we're here now, and we don't know how we got here. We don't know what we're doing here. We don't know anything. We got a few little tricks to manipulate material nature, to do a few little things. And usually what we do goes wrong. Here's a story here about how Japan decided that it wanted to make the right kind of, turn their forests into the right kind of trees, Japanese cedar trees that make really good wood for them that are straight and everything like that. And so they put these cedars everywhere, millions of acres of cedar trees in Japan. So now what happens is huge numbers of the population are allergic to pollen from the cedars. And they say now it's a mistake. Millions of Japanese, the pollen is this extraordinary experiment in environmental engineering. They planted that Japanese cedar. The pollen blows off. You can see it coming like a windstorm. Or they even think it looks like a forest fire when it blows up. It's so thick. And it's become a huge health problem in Japan. You know, and plus, the wood's not selling either. It's threatening wildlife, causing heavy soil erosion, reducing the water table, creating disastrous landslides. And the loggers, the cheaper wood is now coming from Southeast Asia. The cause of pollenosis, as the reaction to the cedar pollen is known, are the products of unprecedented concentration of mature cedars. It is believed that never before have human beings been assaulted by such a huge wave of pollen. People want to scratch their eyes out. With 1 in 10 Japanese affected, the allergies have become a national obsession. By late February, one of the most closely watched items in the news every day is a running count of the cedar pollen in the air. Tokyo has two big electronic billboards in which it flashes the figures, and the city runs allergy hotlines. At the peak, you can actually see a pollen fog coming from the cedar forests. It is so bad that when people first began to notice it a decade or so ago, they thought there were forest fires. Anyway, let me see. So, just to show what happens when we improve things. Yeah, anyway, you can. Every week it comes, you know, another lesson. So even when we can do a few tricks, and usually when we do our few tricks, they backfire in so many ways, you know. Because people are really just, they don't know what they're doing, you know. When you don't understand how to mess with material nature and fix it up and change it, they have no idea what they're doing. So they planted all these, you know, all these bright guys sat down, figured it all out, planted all this cedar trees, you know, and it all went, oh, we didn't think of that, right? Okay. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.